People think they know you, your race, your gender, your class. But if they take a closer look, the person they thought they knew, they might not know at all. On the next Snap Judgment, from PRX and NPR, Second Skin. Snap Judgment, storytelling with a beat. Do not miss it. This Snap Judgment podcast is supported by MailChimp. More than 5 million people and businesses around the world use MailChimp to send email newsletters, and MailChimp also distributes hats for cats and small dogs. More at MailChimp.com. So, 7th grade, a big bully, Matt, he said he was going to beat me up good after school. I told him that I love to fight him, I long to fight him, but once I reached the Golden Lotus level of Aikido, my sensei forbade me to use my training except in the protection of others. Matt sneered, "Golden Lotus? What belt is that?" "What belt? What belt? When you reach this level, there's no belt." And all the kids around me nodded, like, of course, everybody knew that Golden Lotus is not to be trifled with. I bowed to Matt, who was still angry, but he stepped aside as I walked past him to my locker. Thing was that simply by declaring myself master of the martial arts, I felt like I moved lighter on my feet, more cat-like, more ready for the dangers lurking within Valleywood Middle School. I chopped at shadows, made Bruce Lee noises whenever appropriate, like a new me. The rumors spread were better than anything I could have come up with myself, that I could kick bricks in half. Charlie said he saw me catch a fly with chopsticks. Janet swore I did a backflip off Andy's shed. I stopped moving out of the way of Matt and Frank and the bully boys in the hallway. Instead, I stared until they moved out of my way. Power, like a scrawny kid never had before, a new dawn. And in the end, I didn't say what Renee Peterson thought I said. I told her she needed to wipe the mustard off her lip. She thought I told her to wipe the mustache off her lip. She turned around, picked me up, and threw the Golden Lotus through two glass doors. On the ground, through the pain, I heard people whispering that he's not so tough. Today, on Snap Judgment, from PRX and NPR, we proudly present Second Skin.
Second Skin.
Amazing stories from real people pretending to be something they are not. My name is Glenn Washington. Please buckle up because you're listening to Snap Judgment. Snap Judgment. Now then, we're going to start off today's Second Skin episode with a story from a man forced to assume a role that he never saw coming.
Per Gullestrup was the CEO of a Danish shipping firm called the Clipper Group. And on November 8th, 2008, he received the kind of news that no CEO of a shipping firm wants to receive.
And it was, as I recalled, early afternoon on a Friday, and one of my colleagues came to my office and said that we've just had an alarm go up from the CC Future. And then, because we could track the vessel, we could see that the ship was starting to move erratically. And at that point, we knew that something terribly was amiss.
The CC Future was a cargo vessel that had been passing through the Gulf of Aden off the Somali coast, and Per soon learned that it had been hijacked successfully by pirates.
You get the first initial shock, and you kind of take that in. And then it was just utter disbelief and frustration, because as a ship owner, you find out very, very quickly that you are absolutely alone with this, because then the cavalry is not coming to the rescue here. I mean, you cannot call 911 and then say, hey, my ship is hijacked, come and help me.
Right, so this is not Captain Phillips.
No. I wish I could have called the American Navy when it happened, believe me.
But still, Per knew that didn't make him any less responsible for the lives of the hostages. There were 13 crew members, mostly Russian, who were now being held ransom. They had never met Per, but he was their boss, and it was his job to get them home.
Because we're not sitting there on front line and taking this. It's the crew members that are paying the price here. And yeah, we can go home and eat our dinner and turn on the television and go to bed again. But we're not sitting out there taking what they've been taking, because you need to put yourself in the shoes of a seafarer who's being held hostage by 15-year-old Somalis who are crazed on cat with Kalashnikovs, who don't sleep for days on end, who are threatening the crews with all sorts of things, sometimes even physical abuse. And this psychological trauma that they experience, the longer that goes on, the bigger the chances that they will not be able to go back to have a normal life.
Per's goal was to get his crew back safe and sound as fast as possible. So he hired an outside consultant. That's what most shipping companies do in this kind of situation. And the first thing the consultant did was hire a middleman, a dedicated negotiator that would act as a buffer between them and the pirates. In this case, it's a person who will only know by his first name, Stephen.
Having a person like him in a situation like this is paramount. If you've never dealt with this before, you're just not prepared for it, because you don't want to get emotionally involved in the situation, because there's a great risk that you're going to lose your cool, and also you're going to make mistakes detrimental to the crews that are sitting on the ship.
Per already knew of another CEO who had tried to negotiate with the pirates personally, no middleman, and had dragged out for over 2.5 years under terrible conditions, which is why Per had no problem using Stephen, who would be the only person allowed to talk to the pirates directly.
And he'd always do that from his car, and I don't know why exactly he did that, but that's the way he operated. And then he would have to have a tape recorder with him, and every single conversation would be taped, and then they could be played back to us afterwards.
Hello?
Hello, how are you, Stephen? This is Ollie.
These are the recordings from the actual negotiations. The guy Stephen is speaking to, Ollie, is the pirate's own middleman.
Hello, Ollie, how are you?
He was the only person allowed to call or receive calls from Stephen, and he was very well-spoken, very friendly, very polite.
How is the crew?
They're doing great.
They are? Okay, I'm glad to hear that.
And he introduced himself and said that the pirates were demanding $7 million in ransom to release the ship, and could we please think about that and then come back to them once we were ready to pay.
And if you're thinking $7 million is a small price to pay for 13 people, well, you're absolutely right. There's just one problem.
It would be easy as a ship owner to just succumb to the first demand that the pirates may come with. But the net result of that would be that they say, oh, yeah, but that was just the down payment we were asking for. And before you know it, you have a situation that escalates.
More often than not, agreeing to the pirates' initial asking price would just drag things out even longer and make things much worse for the crew. Because if you could pay $7 million, who's to say you couldn't pay $10 or $12? And once the pirates knew you were willing to pay that much, there would be nothing stopping them from hijacking more vessels and ransoming more people for even more money in the future.
So in other words, unfortunately, you got to go through the motions and counter that demand with an equally ridiculously low counter offer.
This is Stephen. Our offer is $400,000.
Almost like buying a used car and give them a feeling that they're actually working for their money.
In regards to the $400,000, they say no. $400,000 is a change.
But $7 million, that's a very unrealistic figure.
And it may look strange and it may look ridiculous and it may come across that the ship owner is out there to try and save money for himself, but nothing is further from the truth.
And the strategy worked. Within 48 hours, the pirates had already dropped their demand from $7 million to $5 million.
Which is not unusual, right? But not having dealt with this before, I said, wow, I mean, at least that's a couple of million dollars closer to a resolution of the problem. And that was professional pride that they, in a sense that I wanted to bring them home as soon as we could. And we had a goal that we wanted to do it before Christmas. But then it kind of stalled there. And we were going back and forth for weeks on end because the pirates really wouldn't come down on their demands. And we were just at a stalemate.
You have this strategy that you have to wait them out. It's a kind of a staring contest. And
the ground rule here is you never make two offers in a row. That is one ground rule that went through this whole thing.
But Ollie was insisting that Stephen do just that. And the pirates tried a whole bunch of tactics to put pressure on Pear's team to get them to make that second offer. They would trash equipment, claim that a hostage was having a nervous breakdown, or threaten to remove the entire crew to the Somali mainland.
That's the truth. That's what exactly they
want
to do. Are you there?
I am there. I fully understand. I read you. But we need to go back to this negotiation, and it won't do any good to the crew.
No. Listen. It is your mistake. I just dragging your feet.
The worst thing was when they called up and said that one of the crew members had a heart attack. Because there you have a situation where you have to ask yourself, is this a ploy or is this real? And and if it was real, what could we do? You realize that you have very few options, if any, and you are absolutely powerless.
To make matters worse, they knew the ship was running out of food and fuel. Food could be brought over from the mainland, but once the vessel ran out of fuel, it would make it much harder to bring the crew home.
It's the waiting game, and during that waiting game, of course, all kind of thoughts goes through your head. And there was a point where I even toyed with the idea of, you know, calling the Russian embassy and then see if they would do a rescue operation, you know, with a SWAT team. But lying in the bed awake at night, that's where these things, they come back and they haunt you and you think about it.
And then how did you feel once Christmas rolled around?
I was very sad. Because we all want to be with our family at Christmas, and then still they were sitting out there, and their next of kin was sitting back in Russia, that was a bad situation.
But then, just before New Year's, the pirates finally made a counteroffer, $3.2 million. Stephen moved up to one, but then Ali misunderstood. He thought Stephen had said two, and things just went downhill from there.
It was $2 million
the day before
yesterday.
No, I did not said that my boss was offering.
Yes, you said so.
But as I see it, it's your mistake because you are not paying attention to what I'm saying.
It is not my mistake. You did this intentionally.
You know our offer, okay? Listen.
And then it was the Friday, the 3rd of January, and I was sitting with my wife in our sitting room, and it was 8 at night. And then my mobile phone rings, and I pick it up, and I saw it was a Somali prefix. And the minute I saw that, I knew what it was. I mean, in a split second, I knew who was at the other end of that telephone. And I looked at it for a few seconds, and that's when I decided to take the call. Then the person on the other line said, this is Ali, Muhammad Ali from the CC Future. And I think I responded something. Yes, I know who you are.
But we just had a conversation about, you know, other CEOs who made this decision and really screwed things up for the hostages. What triggered you to pick up?
It was a spur of the moment decision. And I felt very strongly on a psychological level that, I mean, now he'd finally gotten through to the CEO of the company, and he would do everything in his power not to lose that contact again. So I was very forceful with him that if I was going to spend time on this, that he was not going to do any silly stuff. And, you know, unless you really want to resolve this situation, then don't waste my time.
Ollie agreed to the new ground rules, and he promised. No more lies, no more fake heart attacks, no more silly stuff.
What happened then is Monday, as I'm in the office with David, he does exactly that.
Hello? Ali?
No, it's the captain.
He gets the captain on the phone, and he has the captain start pleading.
The offer of $2 million was said from the company by Steven. That means the pirates do not agree lower than two. They need $2 million, and not on a Saturday, today on the table by fax.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying, Captain, but we...
And also, please, don't break the deal. Otherwise, it can be really dangerous for everybody. I mean, for everybody who's still on board.
And I only saw one way of dealing with it.
Listen, Captain, could I speak to Ali?
He cannot talk to you.
Okay.
And there I really blew my gasket because that was so obvious what he was trying to do.
I will not talk to anybody but Ali, Captain, because what he is doing now is he is trying to use psychological pressure, and I will not accept that. He has one chance to talk to me, or we will cut off this line of communication. There will be no more communication with me. Tell him that.
You are not against if the psychological pressure is coming to me and my crew, yes?
That's right, exactly. I'm sorry, Captain, but you will have to tell Ali. If Ali wants to negotiate, he can negotiate with me directly, or I will disconnect the phone and he can call Steven.
Then the line disconnects, and then when he calls back...
Hello?
We're ready for it.
Yeah, hi, Ali. I mean, Ali, let me just make this very, very clear. You called me on Friday. You wanted a meaningful conversation. Don't put this kind of crap on me again.
Nobody's throwing a crap on
me. No, because I don't appreciate that. And you're insulting my intelligence when you're pulling this at me.
And the minute he's contrite...
No. Nobody's playing games with you.
Then you won the battle, right? And then you don't gloat. So let him know, hey, I mean, this is all forgotten. You know, you did a silly move. It didn't work. Let's get on with business.
We still want to finalize this matter. If it is any help to you, we are already at 1 million. We are prepared to send you a fax where we can offer you 1.2 million. But I will only do that if you think it's worthwhile.
I'll talk to you.
All right. Thank you, Ali.
After that, negotiations moved quickly, and Pear actually employed a whole host of strategies. Instead of just making offers, he'd make certain demands of his own, that the ship had enough fuel to return home, that the crew be kept in good health, things Ollie had to do to earn Pear's trust.
Because I knew he had lived in the States, I tried to use American metaphors.
Yeah, I mean, they gotta wake up and smell the coffee here.
And also, in our analysis of Ali, we had a sense that he had high thoughts of himself and that he was, you know, above the pirates. And so I said, we may as well play along.
Thank you.
Okay, I'll leave it to you, Ali. I'll cross my fingers and hope you can work your magic. Take care.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
All right, thank you. Bye.
Then the final negotiation went down 1 o'clock in the morning, where he calls me up and say, okay, the pirates are at 1.7. And I kind of, oh, woo.
So he would settle at 1.7.
Yes.
And that's based on a drop on Wednesday.
Yeah.
And that's based on the ship having enough fuel to get away.
Yes.
Okay.
I mean, this is 70 days in the pressure cooker, and then finally it's all over and it's done.
We're not going to have any nonsense tomorrow morning. This is under control,
no,
right?
No. No problem, sir.
Okay. All right, Ali. Thank you very much. Let's put this behind us.
No problem.
Okay? We'll talk to you tomorrow. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And that was the end of it. That was the time when I exhaled.
The negotiations were over, and without even meaning to, Pear had actually broken a lot of the rules. He had negotiated with Ollie directly. He had lost his cool, and he even made two offers in a row. But it had worked. The crew was going home.
I got up early the next morning, and I drove into the office, and of course, it's one of those things you never forget, because we send a team to the bank and pick up the ransom, and we bring that into the room, and I walk in, and I just remember that saw that sitting there.
Can you describe what you felt when you saw the money?
Disgust. That's the only way I can express that, because it can never be seen as a victory. How could it? As I said, we've been screwed over by a bunch of hoodlums in Somalia that had done, you know, untold things to our colleagues. But certainly we had an end to the misery for our crew of 71 days, and that was the real issue here, is that we could tell the master and the crew that now they were coming home.
When did you finally get to meet the crew?
I never met the crew, to be honest with you. I met the captain on numerous occasions, but I haven't met the crew. We had people from the company go and meet the crew, but I didn't go myself. And it that's one of the regrets I have today, is I didn't go myself. I should have.
Why didn't you go?
I don't know. To be honest with you, I just always fear of being perceived of being callous or non-emotional. But if you're doing the right thing, you feel you're doing the right thing, and you're staying true to yourself, then what else? Maybe it's just me, I don't know.
Has any of them ever tried to reach out to you?
A few has, yeah. Not just that, but they were happy that we had done everything in our power in dealing with this matter, and we had left no stone unturned. But our measure of success after all this is said and done was, would they go back to sea? And would they go back to sea with us? And we hit 100 on both counts. And that was a confirmation for me that we'd done the right thing.
Pär Gyllenstrup retired from the Clipper Group in 2013, but he stayed in contact with Ali and tried to help him get out of the hostage negotiation business. Today, Pär helps run Somali Fair Fishing. That's reviving the Somali fishing industry in order to provide a sustainable alternative to piracy. To find out more about this story and the piracy problem, check out two documentaries, Stolen Seas on Netflix right now, and the British documentary, The Trouble with Pirates. That piece was produced by Joe Rosenberg with sound design by Pat Mesiti Miller. When Snap Judgment returns, we're going to say vagina on the radio, and we're going to go undercover, deep undercover, without any backup. And Snap Judgment, the Second Skin episode continues. Stay tuned. Now, when you think about the best time to go to the post office, you probably guess before work or after work, maybe during lunch. But you're wrong, because that's when it's the most crowded. Everyone's got the same thought you do. The truth is, there is no convenient time to go to the post office. And that's why you need Stamps.com. With Stamps.com, access all the services of the post office right from your desk. You can buy and print official U.S. postage for any letter or package using your computer and printer. Then just hand it to your mail carrier. So easy. And unlike the post office, Stamps.com is open 24/7 with no lines. So get your mailing and shipping done whenever it's convenient for you. Right now, there's a special offer for listeners of the Snap Podcast, a no-risk trial, plus a $110 bonus offer including a digital scale and up to $55 in free postage. Do not wait. Go to stamps.com before you do anything else. Click on the microphone at the top of the homepage and type in SNAP. That's stamps.com. Enter SNAP and happy mailing.
Thanks for listening to Snap. Imagine you could call up a friend and say, meet me at the bar and tell me what's going on with the economy. Now imagine that's actually a fun conversation. Now stop imagining and subscribe to Planet Money Podcast. Find Planet Money on iTunes along with other NPR podcasts.
Welcome back to Snap Judgment, the Second Skin episode. Today, we're exploring what happens when, for one reason or another, we have to act like someone we are not. And for our next story, Snap Judgment's Nancy Lopez brings us to that vast border between Texas and Mexico.
At 19, Norma isn't proud of what she has to do to provide for her family. She's a single mother living in the U.S. illegally. And she's thinking of a way out when she gets her chance in the least likely of places. One day, her boyfriend gets caught smuggling weed across the border, and she goes to visit him in a Corpus Christi jail.
This agent, DEA agent, approaches me and tells me he wants to talk to me. He explains to me the trouble my boyfriend's in, that I can help him. If I know anything I want to share, anything I say can get me out of trouble. It would be helping my boyfriend and myself. So I sit down with him, with the agent, and I tell him everything I've been doing for the past 3 years.
The agent is Charles, or Charlie as Norma comes to call him, a police officer assigned to the DEA task force in Corpus Christi. What Norma tells them is that when she was 16, her mother's boyfriend sold her to drug traffickers from Mexico to work as a mule.
I had heard that they would kill you before you can get out of it. So I was worried. I didn't know how long this was going to last.
Norma had been making the trip to Mexico twice a month, smuggling 3 pounds of heroin across the border to California for the past 3 years. As she got more comfortable, the trips got shorter and the money got better. Norma even bought a house.
I'm not gonna lie. It felt good in a way. I felt like I was getting out of being poor, having to worry about what we're gonna eat tomorrow. It felt good to have money in my pocket. I was 16. I knew what it was like not to have.
Still, Norma knew this couldn't last forever.
I'm just thinking, what's next? What's gonna take for me to be able to get away from all this? The cartel people knew everything about me. Knew where I lived, knew about my family. It wasn't going to be easy to get out. I was theirs, and they were going to use me till either I got caught or I got killed.
Back in Corpus Christi, Charlie offers Norma a third option.
He tells me that we're going to make a deal. He promised me citizenship, and he promised me witness protection. If I become an informant, if I help them catch something big, they were after something big. I'm relieved, and he made it seem like the right thing to do. And I agreed. I said I would do it.
Charlie connects her with another agent who gives Norma her first assignment. A month later, when she returns from a trip to Mexico, she goes to Corpus Christi, where agents tape a wire to her chest and send her to her usual drop in California.
When I get to California, the people I deliver the car to are mad I took too long delivering. I kept telling them I had car trouble, so it took me longer. But they weren't buying it. They knew something was up. They're unloading the car in a garage. They couldn't find what they were looking for. And one guy came towards me with like a wrench, hitting it on his hand, like in a threatening manner. Like he was going to hit me with it if I didn't say where his stuff was. I'm kind of talking to myself and I was saying, he's coming with a wrench. But they weren't responding. I thought I was going to die. And that's when the DEA agents came in and busted everybody. I thought that was the end of it. But it didn't happen that way.
The DEA busts the California drug traffickers and confiscates 25 pounds of heroin from the operation. That's millions of dollars. And in exchange, Norma says she gets $10,000 and a social security card. She escapes the cartel and starts a new life in Dallas. But instead of permanent resident papers, she gets a temporary permit to be in the country.
I call Charlie and I ask him, and he tells me somebody dropped the ball and there's no paperwork. Nothing is being done.
Can you say to him?
Nothing. Nothing. I never really, I guess I never stood up for myself.
The reality is, as a police officer, Charlie cannot grant citizenship. What he can do is put Norma in touch with DEA agents who can help her get an S visa, also called a snitch visa, for informants like Norma.
Every time he knew of somebody needing help, he would call me. He would tell me, this is your chance. This guy's good. He's one of the best agents. He's gonna give you what you need. And you should talk to him. And I always did.
Norma does things like set up a drug deal over the phone or meet a dealer face-to-face to buy heroin, each time placing herself in danger. And for the risk, each time she gets a temporary permit lasting 6 months to a year. As frustrated as Norma is with the DEA, the one person she can talk to is Charlie.
I would talk to him every week. We were, I don't know, people have asked about this relationship, but we were just friends. If I was feeling bad or if I don't know, if I was going through something hard, I would call him and share my stuff with him. If things were hard at work or if my kid was sick, just regular stuff.
But all of that started to change a few years ago when Norma realizes Charlie can only do so much. This time, she calls Charlie with an operation. A drug dealer has asked her to hide a large stash of cash.
The first thing I thought was, Charlie, maybe they need cash money. Maybe when they see a bunch of money, they'll help me out.
And it's actually common for an informant to get a cut of the money that the DEA captures in a sting.
They always promise you 25% of whatever they get.
Norma wants to use her cut of the money to hire her own attorney to get citizenship. The deal goes down, but afterwards, Norma says they refuse to pay her the money.
They were not going to pay me because I'm illegal. And Charlie, I don't know if he played it off or if he knew all along. At first, he pretended to be mad at the agents, but then he acted like nothing happened.
It might seem like Norma's just mad about the cash, but for her, it's more than that. By this point, she's been working as an informant for 20 years.
I always told Charlie, I'll give you everything for a piece of paper. Don't give me money. I don't need money. I work and I'm good enough with that. I just need to feel free.
And in 2010, Charlie comes to Norma with a new mission.
Charlie told me that I had a real good chance of getting help if I called this guy, and I did. This guy was Rolando. I called Rolando, and I said if he could help me, I would help him.
This time, Norma wants a guarantee.
And I told him that I wanted my papers, and I told him I wasn't going to risk my life again for just a permit. And he told me he couldn't. So I told him I couldn't help him either. We left it at that.
Norma says that 2 weeks later, he calls her again.
He asked me if I had changed my mind, and I told him no. And before he hung up, he asked me if I still lived at the same address, and I said yes. Early the next Monday, around 5 a.m, Rolando came to my house with 3 other male agents, and he told me that he was gonna sign me up.
Norma says that the agents gave her an ultimatum: help us or else.
He wanted me to sign up for an operation to help them bust a Border Patrol agent who was charging to cross illegals. He told me that he was gonna deport me and take my daughter to CPS. I had to agree. He really didn't leave me a choice. They told me they were gonna be in contact with me.
A female agent contacts Norma, but then she learns how Norma got pulled into the operation. She tells Norma she's been compromised, cancels the operation, and sends her home. Norma says she's relieved, until she gets a call from Agent Rolando.
He called me to the McAllen office. He said I was a troublemaker. He took my papers. I still had a permit for a year left. He turned my purse upside down. And he got an agent to escort me to the Hidalgo Bridge. And he deported me.
Just like that, she's in Mexico. And Norma's afraid, fearing retribution from the old drug cartel.
I couldn't call anybody. A week later, I swam the river to get home to my family.
Norma finds her way back to Dallas, but she knows she's in trouble. So she goes to see an advocate who can find her an immigration attorney willing to take on her case.
Nothing I said to him, he believed, because I was nervous. I couldn't sit still.
The advocate had heard thousands of deportation stories, but he'd never heard one like Norma's. And then she handed him business cards of the different agents she'd worked for.
That's when he got, I guess, excited, because he couldn't believe something like that could happen.
The first person she told him to call was Charlie.
He knew my situation. He knew everything I had done. And I thought he would help me.
Charlie recently retired from the force. He doesn't want to talk, but he does help. He writes a letter on Norma's behalf. In it, he says Norma helped the government and that her help was very substantial. He writes that Norma has been a good example of a caring citizen and that he has spoken with her on several occasions. If she were deported to Mexico, he continues, he feels she would be a target for retaliation by the cartel she used to work for. But even with this letter, no lawyer has yet to take her case. Because of her criminal past, they all tell her they can't do anything for her. The only thing she can do is tell her story.
I spoke to my advocate, and he has a group of reporters. He would tell me, talk to them, tell them everything they ask, everything you know.
And that's exactly what Norma has done. That's all she has left.
I can't regret things that I've already done. I just wish I could have done things different. And yeah, some people took advantage of me, but I'm still here. I'm still fighting. Sometimes I feel like I'm one of the lucky ones. I'm still alive.
Norma, please stay safe. Thank you so much for sharing your story to Snap. We first heard about Norma's story from Yolanda Gonzalez-Gomez's investigative report, Double Crossed by the DEA. we'll have a link on our website, snapjudgment.org. That piece was produced by Nancy Lopez with sound design by Renzo Gorio. When Snap Judgment returns, we're kicking it live on stage with a young man trying to be something he most certainly is not. Snap Judgment, the Second Skin episode, back in just a moment. Stay tuned.
Thanks for listening to Snap. Heard something in the news about the economy that you just don't get? Turn to Planet Money from NPR. It's a clever take on topics of money and markets and making it fresh and exciting. Look for NPR's Planet Money on iTunes under podcast.
To Snap Judgment from PRX to NPR, the Second Skin episode. My name is Glenn Washington, and it has been far, far too long since we've had this guy on this show. Oh yes, Snap favorite, Josh Healy returns, so take the best seat in the house, because he's about to take the Snap Live stage. Get ready.
This guy is a storyteller, and I say that because you never know where he's going to go. Please put your hands together. He was with us on our very first episode, Mr. Josh Healy.
When I was in high school, I was co-president of my school's drama club, and I loved it. I loved the costumes. I loved all 11 people who came to our shows. And most of all, I loved my drama club co-president, Sophia Feingold. Oh, Sophia Feingold. Half Jewish, half Puerto Rican, she was the Jew-Eurekan queen of my heart. Sophia was brilliant. So brilliant, she spent most our senior year taking extra classes over at the local university. And she hung out a lot at the campus women's center there and came back to school one day wearing this t-shirt that read, "This is what a feminist looks like." And I thought, wow, feminists look good. Now, Sophia and I, we had to pick a show for our drama club's annual spring play. And she told me she had this really exciting idea. She said, "Josh, there's this show. It's blowing up at all the colleges around the country. I really think we should do it. It's called The Vagina Monologues." I said, "What? What show do you want to do at our high school senior play?" She said, "Josh, it's a great show. You're going to love it. It's all about celebrating women's voices, our bodies, our power. Now, normally, it's an all-female cast. But we're not going to do it the normal way." I said, "We're not?" She said, "No, Josh, we are gonna do the first ever co-ed vagina monologues. And I've got the perfect role for you. It's called My Angry Vagina." I said, "Whoa, Sophia, that sounds like a pretty major role. I'm not sure I've got what it takes. She said, if any guy can do it, Josh, you can. And I wasn't sure if I was supposed to take that as a compliment, but Sophia Feingold was smiling at me, so I was like, of course, of course, of course, of course I'll do it. I mean, anything for the drama club. But in the back of my head, somewhere, I was like, could I really pull this off? My angry vagina. I was gonna have to do some research. So I went right to the record store and bought every Ani DeFranco album I could. Listened to them all weekend long, rocking that Ani. And when I came into the theater for the first day of rehearsal, I saw the rest of the cast. 4 girls and 4 very excited, totally confused guys. Each of us with our own monologue on a different issue. A girl's first period. A woman giving birth. A woman being raped. And of course, my monologue, which was a rant against the oppression of tampons and douches and every OBGYN tool that could really piss a woman off. Or so I was learning. This was definitely gonna be an educational experience. But there were some people, though, who did not see it quite that way. Like every guy on my soccer team, who every day at practice would ask me questions like, hey Josh, hey Josh, hey, how's that play going? You get fitted for your panties yet? No. Meanwhile, Sophia's friends, her own friends, the college feminists, they weren't too happy either. This one woman came by rehearsal to tell us, what is this? This play is about women speaking in our voices. Which seemed like a decent point to me. But then Sophia said, hey, if we want to have good men later on, then we need to have good boys now. Which also seemed like a pretty good point. Especially when she looked over in my direction and winked. So the show was on. And buzz was building. And tickets were almost sold out. And then one day, the rest of the cast called me and Sophia in for a meeting. They said, we need to talk. And this one girl said, look, guys, we've been talking a little bit and maybe those college girls were right. I mean, this co-ed idea is fun and all, but these are some serious women's issues. We should be the ones talking on them. Sophia, she did not like anyone questioning her vision. She said she was furious. This is how we're gonna do the show. Right, Josh? And she looked over at me. And everybody looked at me. And I looked over at Sophia. Then walked over and joined the rest of the cast. Sophia didn't say a word. She just stormed off. Until 1 month later. 1 month to the day later, I walked back into the theater for the big premiere. And the place was packed. Even the soccer team was there. The lights went down, the curtain went up, and when the first performer finished her monologue, every girl in the crowd was on her feet cheering. Every guy in the crowd was sitting in his seat fidgeting uncomfortably. Every parent in the crowd was wishing we had done Hamlet again. And then came the monologue I'd been waiting for. The one I knew all the lines to. And she walked slowly to the middle of the stage. And before she even said a word, she just looked out into the audience. And in that look, in that one look she gave me, I saw more than just anger. I saw her strength. I saw her conviction. I saw a fierce female power that I could only imagine, and I realized that was my co-president up there. That was her role up there on the stage, mine here in the audience. And it was all leading up to this. And Sophia Feingold took a step forward and said in the loudest, proudest voice I'd ever heard, "My vagina, it's angry. It's pissed off. My vagina, it's furious, and it needs to talk."
Josh Healy from Snap Live at the Nokia Theater at LA Live in front of the big lights of Los Angeles in conjunction with our station partner KPCC in LA. The music for that piece was written and performed by Alex Mandel and the Snap Judgment players David Brandt and Tim Frick. We'll have links to the world that is Josh Healy on our website, snapjudgment.org. Just listen to Snap Judgment, the Second Skin episode. Please remember, never forget that even if you missed a moment, the full episode, podcast, pictures, movies, stuff, it's available for you right now. SnapJudgment.org. Officially declared the hottest show ever by scientists with lab coats at Snap Judgment. Our Facebook is Snap Judgment. Our Twitter is Snap Judgment. Snap was produced by the team that has several sets of clothes. Slam your bottles of rum together for the Uber producer, Mr. Mark Ristich. Pat Mesiti Miller, Julia DeWitt, Anna Sussman, Joe Rosenberg, Renzo Gorio, Davey Kim, Jasmine Aguilera, Nancy Lopez, and Will Urbina. Finally want to figure out how to work your TV remote, you have only to call the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. They can't wait to help out with any household chores. Let them know much love to the CPB. PRX, the Public Radio Exchange, never call them Prex. They don't like that. PRX.org. WBEZ in Chicago has a plan to put Chicago within WBEZ. And this is not the news. No way is this the news. In fact, you could make a fake you out of stuffing and straw. You could sit the fake you at your desk. Give it painted eyes with a "I'm listening" expression. And you could go to Brazil for 6-7 months. And when you return, you could discover you've gotten 2 promotions. And you would still not be as far away from the news as this is. But this is NPR.